Now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
In a rebirth of biblical proportions, the environmental movement transmuted into a powerful, positive message of hope, health, and prosperity. As nations around the world continue to fight the old wars over old ideas, a whole new global society is forging ahead with hands wide open for a working alliance amongst the enlightened new leaders of the new free world. Passions are rising. Alliances of all sorts are changing the world. Get ready to hop on a hope-bound flight to wonder when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
A few weeks back, the Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News took an in-depth look at whether environmentalism was dead. Well, today, I have to laugh, because something is changing, and perhaps that tough look made a difference. What's amazing is that this thing that we call environmentalism is taking on a whole new refurbished image, no longer associated with old politics. The newly enlightened Earth Alliance is here. We hear each day the old captains of the old guard, old industries, as they try to make sense out of the ancient old wars between ancient old nations over crumbling ideas and dying visions. Is Iraq the last bastion of the old guard? The oil wars for old energy are getting really old. I'm intrigued by the new energy wars that we hear being launched each day. The battle pits some old players in a new struggle to outproduce and undercut each other in the production of affordable, renewable energy. As the battle rages, who are the victors? Us. It's a new day as good old competition starts battling to produce the cheapest, safest energy, because those who succeed will become phenomenally wealthy. Hooray for us. In a moment, I will bring you the news which will bring to light reports from the front lines of the new energy wars. And following the news, we turn our attention to a love story. A love story for the Earth. It centers on a legendary Shakespearean actress and film star who meets a wild-spirited biologist who brought the songs of the humpback whales to our awareness. Married, still creating and researching, Lisa Harrow and Roger Payne join us from their home in Woodstock, Vermont. You will love this private excursion into the private passions of two of the world's great creative geniuses. This is a special extended edition of the Wild Side News. So settle back and get ready for another great adventure. But first, the news. This week, the new energy wars were launched. A day after Governor Schwarzenegger's Million Solar Roofs initiative was announced, Germany's top solar energy policymaker, Dr. Hermann Scheer, commended the governor for engaging in the new battle. In a statement, Dr. Scheer announced, "In Germany, we have found that solar power is beneficial to our overall economy, bringing new industry, jobs, and stable electric rates. I strongly encourage California to make a similar commitment to solar power as Germany and Japan. With the amount of annual sunshine and rapid economic growth, California would easily become the global leader in the solar industry." Meanwhile, the Chinese top legislature voted to pass China's first renewable energy promotion law, which will help the country meet ambitious targets for renewable energy. Greenpeace International Steve Sawyer stated, "China could and should be a world leader in renewable energy development. The international community will get behind China and support its ambition to become an international clean energy powerhouse. As Germany and Japan forge ahead, the war is engaged to see who will win. We hope to announce the winner in the very near future. Bets are on that the winner may be us." On the old war front, the Senate is preparing to shut down over the attempt by Senate Republicans to attach the bill authorizing drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil and gas to a budget measure. Republican leaders indicated Tuesday that they plan to press the issue of drilling as part of a so-called budget reconciliation process, which cannot be subject to a Democratic filibuster. As this bill is one of President Bush's top energy priorities, every attempt is being made to get the job done. Good old Republican Senator Pete Domenici, chairman of the Energy Committee and a strong supporter of refuge oil development, said he was very optimistic we're going to get the ANWR provision in this budget. Meanwhile, ConocoPhillips and BP have pulled out of Arctic Power, a pro-drilling lobbying group financed by the state of Alaska. Chevron Texaco left the group earlier. Interior Secretary Gail Norton downplayed these developments and said she is confident oil companies will be found to bid on the leases. She characterized the need to drill ANWR for oil as a national security issue. And speaking of Gail Norton, the BLM has reversed a 34-year-old ban on the slaughter of wild horses that run free in the West. The legislation was passed removing the slaughter ban when Senator Conrad Burns, Republican from Montana, attached the amendment to a spending bill that President Bush signed into law. We will bring you timely updates on the new energy wars being waged as the new National Security Alliance struggles to win the war for energy independence. And that's the news. And now, a few announcements. Next week, we bring you the Apollo Alliance in depth. And on March 24th, we talk with New York Times bestselling author John Perkins, whose book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is sending shockwaves around the world as he reveals the underside of development and the effects such has had and is having on the living systems around the world. And please, send me your emails with your ideas, thoughts, and join the Voice of the Earth family of friends. I thank you all for listening. Our numbers are growing each week. Hey, invite your friends to come along. And now, we turn our attention to our special edition of the Voice of the Earth. In 1991, at a Greenpeace rally to save the whales, noted whale biologist Dr. Roger Payne was speaking about whales, something he knows a lot about, as he was co-discoverer of the wondrous knowledge that humpback whales sing. His album, Songs of the Humpback Whales, had changed the way the world thought about these magnificent creatures. Also speaking at the event was the Royal Shakespearean actress and actress Lisa Harrow, who too was making an appeal on behalf of the world's whales. Two stars whose orbits touch, a contact. 10 weeks later, they were married. Today we talk with Lisa Harrow and Dr. Roger Payne about their work now as a team. Lessons from Copernicus, a performance piece crafted and performed by the two, brings science and poetry into the creative crucible to work the ancient magic of the theater to change our world. It's a modern mystery play. Lisa and Roger talk about their ongoing work. Lisa about her new book, What Can I Do? An Alphabet for Living, created from her passion to give us all answers we need to make a difference. And Roger talks about the voyage of the Odyssey, his oceanic journey of discovery, now in its fifth and final year, and featured on PBS. And they perform a piece from Lessons from Copernicus. In this, a Voice of the Earth special edition of the Wild Side News, we stretch the boundaries and broadcast for an hour and a half. It's a fascinating journey with two of the Earth's finest magicians. Come along and let them work their magic on you. Now I have the great pleasure of talking with an extraordinary human being in many respects, Lisa Harrow. She certainly is a well-known actress. She is a Shakespearean actress as well and has worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And she's talking to us from her home, which is in Woodstock, Vermont. Lisa, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. I'm pleased to be here.
Now, somehow you're ending up being a major voice in trying to help save this planet. And let's find out, how did this begin for you?
Well, it began in my childhood in New Zealand, although, because I grew up in New Zealand, and although I wasn't necessarily concerned in terms of being a member of any movement, my father, who is a scientist, kept saying, you know, population, world population, that's all very well, but, you know, your generation, all you can think of is that the world owes me a living, but the population problem is going to get in the way of all of you and you'll have huge problems. And we all used to look at him and laugh when we were young. Well, of course, he was right. And then I came to England and I was there for many years working as an actress. And And in 1991, I went to a Greenpeace rally for whales in Trafalgar Square. I was invited to be one of a group of celebrity speakers. And I had to talk about, I was given a piece to talk about long-range communication of whales across oceans and across many thousands of miles. And I was astonished at that because I had no idea that whales could do all these things. I, unlike a lot of people, had never heard the whale record, and because I think I was too busy doing Shakespeare or something at the time. But anyway, Roger Payne opened this rally for whales, and we met there at the rally, and we were married 10 weeks later. And when I met Roger, I remember writing that it was like standing on the shores of an ocean, and the waves just rolling in, and somehow I knew that I was encountering and finally embracing a much bigger world than just the world of theatrical and film and television acting that I'd been involved with. And so throughout our marriage, I have become more and more involved with the things that Roger's dealing with the issues that he's dealing with. And so now I've written this little book, which I've published in America and is now going to be published in Australia and New Zealand and England and then worldwide, called What Can I Do? An Alphabet for Living, which is a series of websites that you can go to find information that will help us to understand the problems that we face on the Earth today, the problem that the Earth faces, the problem as a living system, the problems that we face through those problems, problems with water and energy and global warming, which is huge, and population and food and everything. I mean, the degradation of every part of the living structure of the Earth. And the simple things that we can do to start changing the way we live on the Earth, to heal it, really, and to heal ourselves, and to start being more considerate about the way in which we squander the resources that we all share with each other. You know, nothing really belongs to any of us. It's all, we are one of millions of species on this planet, and so we have to learn to be more careful with the way we use the resources of this one little home that we have, which is the Earth, which is in this, you know, in the size of the universe, it's pretty tiny.
Lisa, the book is put out by Chelsea Green Publishing, and they're doing some wonderful things in terms of environmental publishing these days.
Yeah.
Going back to the moment when you met Roger, and by the way, for those who don't know who Roger is, can you give us a quick summary since we're starting this program?
Well, Roger is a whale biologist, and some say he's the world's leading cetologist. He very modestly says, no, that's not so. But the reason he became very powerful in the world of whales was because he was the co-discoverer of, along with a man called Scott McBay, of the fact that humpback whales sing. And the sounds that pour out of the ocean are in fact song. And he made a record, well, he made several records, but the first one, the songs of the humpback whales that hit the world, I think, in the late 60s. And it's astonishing yet still how many people meet us and go, oh my God, I remember those. And my children went to sleep with those sounds and how moving they were. And it really transformed the environmental movement. It started, you know, the Save the Whale movement. People suddenly began to realize, oh, that these dark, mysterious monsters of the deep actually had souls and created music and were most beautiful, profoundly beautiful to listen to. And it gave them a sense, or gave us a sense of their magic, that allowed us to go then further into actually examining, what are we doing to these creatures? We were killing them massively at the time. And what's happening with their habitat? And their spirit spoke to us, and so we were able to somehow link into them, and it helped to develop the Save the Whales movement and then other huge environmental movements as a result. So that's who Roger is. His name's Roger Payne.
Legendary human being, and I think, again, I totally agree that his research sort of scientifically proved that there was much more to animals than simply reacting to environmental stimulus. That is to say, they were much more profound than science and many others had been giving them credit for.
That's right. And he also runs in Argentina, down in Peninsula Valdez, the longest single species study that's been going on for 35, nearly 40 years now, of the southern right whale down in this wonderful bay in the wilds of Patagonia, where he took his family when they were young children. And it's interesting, we've just had his family all here with us, and their bond as a family is incredibly powerful because they spent so much time with Roger and his wife out there in the wild, living in the wild world, and connecting with other species apart from our own in a very profoundly challenging and beautiful way, I think, and it's led to four remarkable children.
We're going to have the great pleasure of talking with Roger sort of in our next segment of sorts. But Lisa, let's continue. This is what I'd be curious about at a personal level, because I'm always amazed at when people begin to really expand their awareness of this interconnection of all of life on the Earth, what happened? What happened to you? Because apparently, as you really got to know Roger and you moved from Earth mates to life mates, that is the way I like to think of you two, How did your awareness grow, and your appreciation, your sensitivity? You're already there, but which is therefore great. But what began to happen to you personally? What was your growth like?
Well, I tell you, the first thing that began happening to me is I began to realize how poisonous plastic was to us and to our life on Earth. And very early on in our relationship, a woman called Theo Colburn came for dinner, and she had written with one of the co-writers of a book called Our Stolen Future, about persistent organohalogens, POPs, in the environment, and what these man-made molecules, which are indestructible, which break down in fatty tissues and which get swirled around by the oceans, the winds, and into the ocean, consumed by little tiny creatures in the sea, and then they go up the food chain until they're in the fatty tissue of big fishes, and what and the appalling things that happen to us over generations, and to sea life, and to plant, I mean, to everything, because of these, the infestation in the earth of these man-made molecules. The effect that the Industrial Revolution has had on us. I mean, it's been a wonderful thing, the Industrial Revolution, everything that has come out of the Industrial Revolution, but like all things beneficial, there's always seems to be a downside. And the downsides don't appear until much later. And I guess I began to realize, fundamentally, that we have to be more careful of leaping into a new technology without thinking, without realizing, without considering the consequences. And of course, sometimes the consequences are not even there. I mean, lead and petrol, look how that long it took for that campaign to take off, because people didn't realize for so long that lead and petrol was such a poisonous substance, just particularly to urban children. And so I used to sit in Roger's office and watch these faxes coming in about the death of fisheries and the POPs that were in the food that they were eating, in the natural food from the oceans that they were eating. And so I just became, I'm a very curious person, but I'm also, I feel that nothing here belongs to me. I mean, I'm just passing through, like all of us. I don't feel that I have any right to jeopardize the future health and well-being of any species on this planet by the way I treat the world in which I live. Needless to say, I drive a car, but now I've got a hybrid, but that really doesn't make much difference. And we live in the middle of the country, so we have to use our car a lot more than I would wish. I mean, I'm not a purist in that sense. I just try to be aware of the things that I do. And I guess it was out of that awareness and the consequences of those things that, and then Roger developing this program and this Lessons from Copernicus. And we did it a couple of times in its early stages. And I realized immediately, oh my God, we need a tool, because the audiences kept saying, well, okay, so we buy your message, now what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. What can I do? And as an actress, I heard an audience requiring more information. And now, I would, as an actress, if I was playing a character, would start to enrich my character, but what I realized was that we had to write this little book and give it away to a member of the audience. which is how What Can I Do started out. Now, and then Chelsea Green picked it up, and that was great. But I just look at these things practically and try and find and get excited about the things that are happening in the world that are changing the way we live. And I want the people out there to know about these things and get as much excitement and pleasure out of them as I do.
Lisa, What Can I Do, an Alphabet for Living, again, is put out by Chelsea Green Publishing.
Yes.
I encourage everybody to look at their
full... I also started a website.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is whatcanidousa.org, mm-hmm. to add to the information in the book. Because
excellent.
I keep finding things that should mm-hmm. be in the book and can't be because the book was finished. But so I'm now doing that too, which is something, if you'd said to me a year ago you'd be doing an environmental website, I would have been... I just wouldn't have believed you.
Give us that website.
It's called whatcanidousa.org.
Very good. Now, here's the question that I'd like to, because the book is fabulous. It has, I don't know how many links and descriptions of all sorts of organizations that are doing, it's arranged alphabetically so people can just sort of look up a topic and find out who's doing what and go there and do something, which is yes. what this is about. What have you found, since you've had the opportunity to really pull all of this information together, to be some of your favorites, some of the people who are doing the work that you feel is most important?
Well, there's the book thing down in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of my favorite, because some of the things I do is people who did. And this was one of my favorite guys who was just working in Abadia. Because to me, the most important thing is that ordinary people, you know, normal people like me, not scientists or environmentalists or people with titles, but ordinary people like you and me who are just going about our lives, how we can find the things that can be done. Now, this was a young man who was wandering around America in his car, just doing the odd job, and he was working in a bar in Baltimore, and the teachers kept coming in after school at the end of the day on Friday for their happy hour, and were talking about the fact that, oh my God, there were just no books in the schools, and they had library hour, and what could they do with library hour with no books, and the kids didn't have any books at home. And so this man, Russell, began listening to this, and he thought, I love books, this is crazy. So he picked up the tips from his bar that night, went out the next week, and with his tips every day that week, he bought books from secondhand bookshops and things like that. And the following Friday night, when the teachers arrived, there were a pile of books in the trunk of this guy's car. And he said, take them. And they said, oh my God. He said, no, take them. I just think you need to just take them for the kids. So gradually people began to hear about this, and they start bringing him in books for the book thing, his book thing. So then he took over a building, the basement of the building in which he lived, and he turned it into a place where people could deposit books. And he began very soon collecting 10,000 books a week and giving those books to schools and to homeless people and to old people's homes and to anyone who wanted them. People, and so it became a community place where people kept coming in and looking at things and finding information. And the only the really, really good books he sold, because he could then make money for his non-profit. And he had a list around of all the schools in the area, of all the books they needed that were on their reading list and stuff, and he set them aside and gave them to them. And everything else he just gives away free. Now, a lot of people have books, and they don't know what to do with them because there's so many, and they get dumped. I mean, our local library at Dartmouth, I was talking to them about this, and they dump books, they throw them away. Well, there's another huge problem for us, and that's, what do we do with the waste? I mean, the biggest mountain on the eastern seaboard of America is the trash mountain that Fresh killed, full of trash from New York. Now, trash, garbage, it's beginning to rule our lives because we can't keep manufacturing it and dumping it because there's nowhere to dump it. So one has to start thinking about alternative ways to use trash. So Zero Waste is another site that I really love. And I love, there's also some sites out there under compost, which there are towns in Canada now which are collecting plants, you know, vegetable garbage from homes. You know, when you peel the potatoes and you make the spinach and you cut the bits off and you make the salad, all that stuff that normally goes into the garbage, they're collecting it as compostable material along with paper and cardboard and things like that, and collecting it in these great municipal sites and composting it and turning it into soil and putting it back to the earth. replenishing the soil, which is something else that we're losing fast, rapidly, more quickly than we need to. So it's the interconnectivity of these things that I really love. That's what I, and so the, as you weave through the book, you find, oh, that leads to that, and that leads to that, and of course, the reality is that we live in a closed-loop system, which is one of the things I discovered with working with Roger on this program, and that there, every other species on this planet does not produce waste. We're the only species that produces waste, and we should produce waste that can be recycled. We have to learn how to reuse every single thing that we produce. And now in Europe, there are car manufacturers and manufacturers of other industrial processes, which at the end of the life of that machine that they produce, the machine is taken back and broken down to its component parts and remade into a new one. It's not dumped. That's what Interface Carpets are doing with carpets. They're remaking carpets out of old carpets. And we have to learn to do that. And that's, what does that mean? It means more jobs. It means good business. It means money for the economy. So, in fact, waste is something that shouldn't be. It should be created into new forms of things that we can use. And, I mean, when I talk about waste, I talk about waste of people as well as waste of things. Mm-hmm. So we just have got to think about how we've been living on this planet, which until now has supported us in a very wonderful way, but is no longer able to. And we have to just rethink a bunch of things. And we can do that. We're very smart creatures. You know,
I think actually we're going to reach a point. We're going to reach a critical mass. We're going to find that 100th monkey of awareness. And I think the planet is reaching that point, although it's hard to see. But I can feel it.
We've already outgrown it. In 1972, there was a National Academy of Sciences report which said that that's when we outgrew the sustainable provisions of this planet. And now we need a landmass as big as Europe and Australia to continue to support us where we are now. You know, I mean, we've already extended ourselves beyond the provisions of this planet. But we don't. You're right. We don't see this. I think if we lived in one of these huge bustling cities where the pressure of people was so great that we'd kind of see it, but the challenges
are stacking up, and I think, you know, part of the problem that we have is that the media doesn't really present the message in a way in which leads to real solutions. It kind of is always a crisis, you know. Mm-hmm. And what you've done is you've actually presented this as a what can I do, and really we do have to just do it.
Yeah.
And your book certainly leads to that, to some of those solutions. So I. Obviously, this is one little piece, but an important piece. It's something that every home should have. Not because I'm trying to necessarily promote the book, but because I'm trying to promote the message, which is even more important than the book itself.
Well, I think it's, you know, the funny with things like what you do if you have a wedding and all that food is left over. This is something else that happened. A friend of mine, her daughter got married in our local hotel over in Hanover, and they went round back to their hotel to pick up a car, and all these cheesecakes and food were lying in the bins, and they said, what? And they were untouched. And what they could have done was taken that food and taken it to the hospitals, to the old people's homes, to the homeless who live in the area. Second Harvest is a great organization that's in the book that does just this. And if every single person, when they have a big family gathering, didn't throw away the food, but actually recycled it, gave it to other people, first of all, you would feel that you were actually, you would be providing nourishment to people who don't have good food, and it would be a good thing. But also, more importantly, you wouldn't be, that stuff wouldn't be going into the river bin. It would be being reused or used properly and finished. So that's a great site. There's another site where you can take your old ball gowns and give them to girls so that who are too poor to really, or aren't, you know, don't have the resources to give themselves a beautiful prom dress and a lovely night out for their high school prom. Well, there are organizations now that collect, you know, clothes and shoes and bags, all the stuff that clutter up our wardrobes that we don't, you know, our closets that we don't use anymore, cosmetics, things like that, and make these girls nice. I mean, make change their lives, I think. Now, that's a good thing to be doing. it's really what I'm aiming with this with this book is to make people feel positive about the steps that they take in order to help themselves, because in the end the environment is us and our children and our grandchildren. We're not separate from it. It's not something that's out there, you know, in the green fields. It's within us, because everything that happens out there in the green fields impacts us, our health, our well-being, our mental state, I mean, and our ability to grow and flourish as a species.
So. Absolutely right. You're really addressing the consumerist issue, and we really do have to face this. It isn't anti-corporate, it isn't anti-anything. It really just has to do with the fact that we've reached a point where we simply must change. We have to kind of turn the corner here and start recycling sort of our vision back into our own communities and say we need to help each other out. We don't always have to be buying new. There's many things that we can do, and we need to build these into our societies.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
That's right. I mean, Christmas presents, older children could give younger children, older cousins could give younger cousins their favorite toys when they've outgrown them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that kind of thing can happen too. But it's really just how we deal with this. Because, of course, people are going to say, well, you know, that means that you're cutting out the jobs for the people who make the toys. And that's true. But on the other hand, their population is ever growing. You know, it's not, we don't have a declining population. So people are going to want toys. It's just how we view the... It's got to be a major mind shift, isn't it, really, about realizing that everything that we pick up has come from somewhere and something has been depleted in order to make it. And so does that hairdryer, I mean, that plastic hairdryer that I throw away, or the mobile phones, there's an example. Millions of them in the world now. Batteries are the poisonous thing that go into the landfill. But you know, there are these organizations that, what do you do with your old mobile phone? Well, you can give it to a charity who gives it to people who are in, because they can ring 911 on them for no charge, who may not want to have a mobile phone, but they may want something because they're living under some sense of duress or stress or something, and they may want to have that phone to hand whereby if suddenly they're in danger, or a child is in danger, they can call 911 and be rescued. And so what better thing to do with an old cell phone than to throw it away, and so that it poisons the water that seeps out of the landfill, and you know, all those things. It's just really coming to understand what these complicated issues are and how we set about trying to change our mindsets about it, and that's a really big problem. But that's just the little step I took to help people know where to start looking for the information. That's the important thing. Because once you're informed, you can make decisions much more easily, I think.
Well, Lisa, you've taken a simple step here and outlined a wonderful, simple book called What Can I Do? A beautiful little book, An Alphabet for Living. And that's at a very practical level. But when we come back, we're going to look at some of the more creative and expressive ways in which you, as a Shakespearean actress and and creative person and caring person, are taking this to another level with Roger Payne, your husband. And so when we return, we're going to have a talk with Roger about some of his work, and then we're going to come back in the third segment and put it both together in Lessons from Copernicus, which is a performance piece that you two are bringing to the world. It's a most important statement. Thank you, Lisa Harrow.
Thanks, Sydney.
You bet. Thanks. So to the sea we go. It's a whale hunt for answers to their future and ours. When we return to the special Voice of the Earth edition of the Wild Side News.